You've heard me talk for years about the breakthrough health benefits of CBD. Now, our friends at CV Sciences have developed an innovative suite of non-CBD products that mimic CBD's healthful effects. CV Sciences' new Plus Health CBD-free line of gummies and capsules. The Plus Health Clarity gummies are packed with DMAE, lion's mane, and rhodiola designed to boost your cognitive performance, enhance memory, and provide natural energy. You need a little peace and calm? Plus Health's Peace Gummies, soothing blend of L-theanine, lemon balm, and St. John's wort support serenity and relaxation without the drowsiness. And if you're on a journey towards optimal health, the Reshape capsules are packed with powerful ingredients like berberine and OEA to support metabolic health and help maintain healthy blood sugar levels. For more information and to order, head over to pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman. Use coupon code Hoffman30. For 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for the new Plus Health non-CBD collection. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I'm delighted to inform you that it is once again time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, something that I look forward to every week, and I hope you do as well, because we get all kinds of questions, and you kind of never know what we're going to be talking about. I barely know until I get a little preview just before jumping on the podcast with Layla. And it's an opportunity to hear from you about what your particular health conundrum might be, or alternatively, sharing an experience utilizing some of the supplements and themes that we talk about here on Intelligent Medicine. With us today, Layla Mutin, who is our resident nutritionist. How are you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So here we be, and we're on the cusp of the election. And today we are going to give our recommendations for the choice of presidential candidate for 2024. Right, Layla?
No.
Just kidding. One of the main reasons for that is not merely not to offend our listeners on different parts of the political spectrum, but also possibly because you're seeking to listen to Intelligent Medicine this week as a refuge from the political campaign, which seems to be 24/7, 365, lots and lots of incoming information. Some people may be
seeking refuge. And guess what? I look forward to doing this podcast as a refuge from, you know, getting away from all of that.
Right. Yes. Well, of course, I have sports. See, for me, sports is a refuge because I've got my Yankees are in it. In the World Series.
There you go.
And so I'm very, very excited. But I actually grew up as a Dodger fan in Southern California. So, my second choice would be the Dodgers. But unfortunately, they're pitted against my favorite team, the Yankees. So it should be interesting and a proper diversion, especially as, the campaign gets particularly frenetic with claims and counterclaims just prior to the election. I think most people's minds are already made up. So I just wanted to, before we get to questions, by the way, come to questions@drhoffman.net. That .net part is important because, everything these days .com.
No, otherwise, we're not going to get your questions.
Right. Yeah. Questions@drhoffman.net is the destination for questions. I'm pleased to say that we have quite a few great questions today to answer, but I just wanted to discuss briefly this initiative, this is a story that is based on a study from the University of Washington, because it's often proposed that we have sin taxes on bad foods, and certainly among the worst nutritional items that is most clearly linked to obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular risk, and many, many studies underlie this, are sugar-sweetened beverages. And so they did a study on this proposition. What happens when they introduce beverage taxes does it actually decrease consumption? And one might argue that beverage taxes are futile, because what they do is it's a regressive tax. You know, rich people can afford, you know, I don't care if my Diet Coke or my, you know, six-pack of Pepsi costs more because I can afford it. But somebody who's poor, they're just going to spend a lot of their discretionary income and basically as a what's called a regressive tax, a tax that penalizes poor people more than it penalizes rich people. Progressive taxes, you know, obviously you want to pay your fair share, so-called, if you're rich. So what ended up happening? Well, it's interesting because there are some places, namely in Seattle, San Francisco, Oakland, and Philadelphia, kind of, you know, progressive places where they might vote in a measure like this. You know, Mayor Bloomberg suggested just a kind of a very modest measure in New York, which is to limit the serving size of soft drinks. And he got a lot of blowback. You know, people said, well, it's my right to order a big
it's
gulp.
It's my right to drink a quart of soda.
Right. You know, get like a half gallon at the movies, you know, like, you know, to get the giant size. And so there's a lot of blowback. But in Seattle, San Francisco, Oakland, and Philadelphia, they've inaugurated these. Now, this story does not say how high the taxes are, because if it's trivial, you know, if it's like 5 cents or, you know, even 25 cents, I don't know if that's going to be a big deterrent. So I don't know how much they tax these beverages. But the result, they say, researchers found that after the tax was introduced, lower-income households decreased their purchases of sweetened beverages by nearly 50%. 50%?
Wow.
And that's actually the desired impact, because A, they can afford it less, and B, lower-income households are really at the brunt of the obesity epidemic, right? They're, you know, people can't afford to eat, you know, healthy food, or maybe there's less health literacy. They tend to have poorer food choices and hence more metabolic disorders. While higher income households reduced purchases by only 18%, but still they reduced substantially. So their conclusion is these results suggest the taxes could help reduce health disparities and promote population health. So, you know, what say you? You know, I know that you're more of a kind of a freedom of choice person.
Absolutely.
And you're more, and you know, we I think our presumption here is education, not coercion. But
absolutely.
What say you? Do you think that we should institute
no
these?
No nanny state. Education is very, very important. And maybe it's more out of ignorance. When people don't have the information on hand, people don't realize until they saw the ads on the subways, you know, that sugary drink can give you a heart attack, can give you heart disease. People don't realize that sugar can actually do that, the sugar sweetened beverages especially. Because, you know, when you're drinking a beverage like that, you're not filling up. So then there's you've got a lot of room left to eat a lot more empty calories and processed food and really add fuel to the fire. I think education above all, and let everyone be sovereign as they are and do whatever they wish.
Right.
Do whatever they wish.
Right. Yeah.
Hey, they legalized marijuana.
Right.
You know, if you want to wake and bake.
Well, here's.
Really want to do that?
Here's the thing, though. There are sin taxes related to many of the things whose use we want to somewhat discourage. So, for example, the tax on marijuana products, on cannabinoids here in New York, I think it varies from state to state. It's, in a way, it's the state is collaborating in your vice. Right. You know, just like gambling, you know, because they take their VIG, you know, from that. You know, when they used to have bookies, the state didn't make any money. But now the marijuana dispensaries, they charge a 9% tax in New York.
Yep.
Cigarettes.
They get their revenue off of,
Cigarettes, a different thing. Cigarettes is, I remember when you could buy a pack of cigarettes for $1.80 when I was a smoker, you know, maybe $2, $2.25. Yeah. The tax alone on one pack of cigarettes in New York is $6.35, okay? When it comes to alcohol, I think it's it varies from state to state, but it's I think low double digits. So I have to say I'm a little bit on the fence with this. I mean, I agree with your statement about education, but unfortunately, education is kind of a weak form of suasion for a lot of people. They know better, but they still gravitate sometimes to harmful behaviors. And it actually costs society a lot when people are literally poisoned with these substances. I mean, cigarettes is an example, very clear cut, that, you know, society pays a toll when we have to treat smoking-related disorders. So it would be kind of nice if the monies that were obtained through sweetened beverage taxes would go towards, say, the treatment of diabetics, or if they would go towards educational campaigns to get people to eat healthier, or maybe even food subsidies for healthier foods. But unfortunately, they go into the general coffers, you know, so the government can just spend more on moronic programs.
Yeah. And, you know, they are hypocritical because, you know, they'll tax addictive substances like sugar, like nicotine. Well, what about marijuana?
Yeah.
That can be addictive too. You could be psychologically addicted to, and the same way you would sugar.
Right. Right. I mean, realistically, there are societal harms associated with marijuana.
So they're picking and choosing what to tax and what not to tax.
But for some reason, the makers of these beverages, the multi-billion dollar, food companies and beverage companies, they are held harmless from being penalized for their behavior and for the harm that they inflict on the public. And I think it's time now to, as they so often say, follow the science. The science shows that these have deleterious effects. So is it not unreasonable for society to kind of discourage the use of these things via not just education, but by imposing taxes? I don't know. I think it's one of those questions that I think we need to entertain. Because I'm not entirely sold on this study because it's only 400 households in a few locales, and they claim like a 50% reduction. I'm not sure that this study doesn't have an agenda, you know, that it's like the people who are like the do-gooders who want to put these taxes on bad foods undertook a study and they had a foregone conclusion because, I mean, this is not necessarily authoritative. But, that's why, you know, I'm just putting it out there as a
it's not
something to think about, something to think about.
More of this information is coming to the fore. I mean, there was just a recent roundtable with Senator Ron Johnson.
Yeah.
You know, the health and nutrition. Yeah. All of this is becoming more and more public knowledge, and people can pick and choose what they want to do about their health.
Right.
I think every sovereign human being should have that right, good or bad. You know, just like the First Amendment, I may hate what you say, but I will defend with my life.
Right.
Your right to say it.
The other issue, though, is that there appears to be no moral hazard limited moral hazard to undertaking unhealthy behaviors. Because if you have an entirely subsidized medical system, they'll take care of you. In fact, they may give you free Ozempic, or free munch. Because if you fatten up on these sugar-sweetened beverages, the government may and insurance companies may have a plan for you by which you can mitigate the damage. Yeah, I don't know.
Right, they're giving it to kids.
Look, there's no question that questions like these will be at the forefront of our health policy. And, RFK Jr. and, people like Kasim Kali-Means and Ron Johnson and all the people who are advocates for Make America Healthy Again, like the slogan or not, they're going to put these issues front and center in our political discourse. And I think we're going to have to think long and hard about how we can improve the health of Americans without curbing the freedom of Americans. I think that's really the question.
Yes. Yes. Fair enough. Okay.
So anyway, Before we get to questions, good point.
Yes.
Which we want to take care of business. And so let's allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So listen up, here goes. You've heard me say for years that NT-Factor is the breakthrough supplement that's proven to repair and renew your body's cells. That includes your immune cells, such as your T-cells and white blood cells. NT-Factor has been shown to contribute to a more robust and effective immune response. So now that we're in cold and flu season, NT-Factor is combining with powerful antioxidants, vitamin C and D, to provide you with an immune booster bundle. Vitamin C and D help stimulate the production of white blood cells and activate immune cells, which play a key role in defending against pathogens. Together with NT-Factor, they help modulate immune function, reduce inflammation, and promote overall immune health. For a limited time, buy a bottle of NT-Factor with D3K2 and get a bottle of C1000 with NT-Factor absolutely free. That's a savings of over $26. Just go to NTFactor.com. That's NTFactor.com. Save over $26 on the powerful cocktail of vitamins C and D with NT-Factor at NTFactor.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to our questions. No, I just want to add that.
Yeah.
You know, apropos our sponsors, you know, what a pleasure it is to conduct my own independent intelligent medicine podcast. Because when I was working for a radio station, you know, I was a salaried employee of a radio station. They used to come at me, and they used to say, you know, come on, Dr. Hoffman, can't you just, you know, abandon your scruples a little bit, loosen them up a little bit, and just get behind this product? I mean, it would be so helpful to our bottom line at the radio station to get this sponsor. And I would say, you know, I got to say, I just don't believe in that. And they would, eventually I got this reputation as the Department of Unsales. is, you know, they would just, these eager salespeople would come to me with a prospective new sponsor, and I would say, I'm sorry, it just doesn't go. And I felt, you know, all this pressure and suasion to just roll over and you know, compromise my values. And with the sponsors that I have, you know, I have full control, and I'm very happy to endorse the messages that they're putting out. So I just want to, you know, say that it's not just to improve our bottom line here on Intelligent Medicine and subsidize our, you know, our operation here, that we have commercial underwriting. It also is, you know, part and parcel of a message that we share about plausible paths to good health. End of sermon.
All right. Going to questions. This email comes from Chrissy. I got to read all of your brilliant work on several subjects. My curiosity, which I'm sure you've covered, is what is natural flavoring? I read it on everything because I read ingredients and it seems more common now. And Chrissy says, when I sold Shaklee, remember Shaklee?
Yeah.
It was back in the 70s.
Yeah.
They always told us that the first three ingredients on any ingredient label are the main ingredients. And what do you think?
Okay. And, you know, I just going to out Chrissy, because yeah. Chrissy is one of my classmates of the class of 69 Santa Monica High School. And I recently had an opportunity to get together with her when I went out to California for our 55th high school reunion. And, you know, it's so much fun to hang out with these people. I mean, she was at the time I was in high school, a beautiful blonde cheerleader. And I just, I was really intimidated about going up to the beautiful blonde cheerleaders when I was a geeky high school student. And now at, you know, the 55th reunion, we can all get together. We've leveled the playing field, so to speak. And, you know, so it was really a pleasure to see Chrissy, who is, you know, 55 years later, still beautiful, and, you know, has, you know, a big family of her own. So, Chrissy, when it comes to natural flavoring, it's a little bit of a slippery definition, because there are criteria that the FDA set for natural flavorings. They say, and I'm quoting from their verbiage, It's a substance that is derived from a natural source, such as a plant or animal, and is used to add flavor to food. So, an example of which is some kind of essence that they distill from strawberries to make strawberry ice cream that's strawberry flavored but doesn't have any strawberries in it, you know, and or a juice drink that has, quote, natural flavoring, which is kind of a, it's kind of a weasel word, you know.
Manufacturers actually are increasingly using enzymes to extract flavor compounds from plant sources, like maybe like strawberries, to help meet the demand for that type of flavor. Now, these natural flavorings are meant to enhance the flavor and not necessarily contribute any kind of nutritional value. But I know that on some savory foods, when I see something listed as natural flavorings on, say, a can of soup or some kind of a processed meat product, when I see natural flavors, it normally means monosodium glutamate.
By any other word. Yeah, you know, like a... The yeast derived, blah, blah. If they can, if they can make any kind of connection to a natural source, no matter how processed it is, they can call it natural. This is as opposed to, it is a little step better than, you know, FD&C dye number, number five, you know, yellow or tartrazine or something like that. These are actually petrochemical products. They're actually byproducts of the fossil fuel industry because, you know, through the miracles of chemistry, you can tweak oil from the ground into chemicals that are used as artificial flavor. Those are artificial flavorings.
That red color in particular, that particular food dye is known to cause inflammation in the GI tract and may be a contributor to inflammatory bowel disease.
But also,
you know, in Europe, when they use a red color, they're using beta carotene.
Yeah.
They're using something natural. But here,
But also, you know, the neurological effects, and this is the basis of the Feingold diet, is that originally intended to deal with urticaria, because these artificial flavorings are highly allergenic and caused hives and skin itch. And a pediatric allergist named Dr. Feingold discovered this in the 1960s and 1970s. He published the Feingold diet, but he discovered that they also had improvements in their attention. And then the Feingold Association became a phenomenon where, you know, parents and health practitioners got together to try and ban these substances from the food supply, or, you know, at least put kids on a therapeutic diet without artificial colorings and flavorings. And the net result is that kids' behavior improved. So these may have profound effects. Well, so the natural flavorings, I guess we could... We can't completely exonerate them, but we can say that maybe they're a step better than the, chemicalized artificial alternatives.
Absolutely. They're going to be better than the artificial alternative. So, you know, when you're left to choosing a food item that's got natural flavors versus, you know, Color Lakes number 40, red color, any other color or anything like that, or other artificial vanilla flavor you might find, for instance, on a yogurt or an ice cream.
Yeah, that can be made chemically. That can be made, you know,
that can be made chemically, So you want to avoid those.
So the other question is, we'll tell you different questions. The first three ingredients on a food package ingredient list are the most...
They're the main ingredients.
Yeah,
because it goes in order, of what percentage is in the volume of it.
But, you know, if there's even like way down the list, like the number 19th item is like a really bad chemical or preservative or, you know, an emulsifier, even in a tiny amount, that may be deleterious. So I think you have to
Be, because if you're getting more than a serving size and you have to factor in how often are you eating this food, oftentimes at the end of an ingredient label, you may see contains less than 2% of the following.
Yeah.
And those are where you may see your preservatives and emulsifiers and other kinds of things. So it's a little bit of a, okay, well, I'm not going to eat this that often. I'm going to eat this one time, to hell with it. I'll buy it and eat it. But if you're eating something like this regularly, whatever that food item may be, how often do you want to be ingesting that stuff?
The problem is that often in that first three ingredients, and this is testimony to how much they add, is a form of sugar. It's fructose or high fructose corn syrup or dextrose, which is another regional word for sugar.
Found it in a lot of bottled salad dressings, for example, things that you would think are healthy.
I wanted to make my own homemade salad dressing, and I used a little dash of mustard, and with really high quality balsamic vinegar and olive oil. But I was surprised at how sweet it was, and then I looked at the mustard container. It was like this, artisanal, really stone ground mustard, but it had sugar in it. So I was.
You've got to use Dijon.
Yeah, I know.
The Dijon balsamic is better. Yeah. I know.
I got snookered.
And they'll add sugar to that. They're adding sugar to too many things, honestly. Yeah. I mean, we know obviously barbecue sauce and ketchup and things like that, but it's pretty much everywhere.
So we're getting it from all sides.
Okay.
All right.
Chrissy, thank you for that question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
All right. We've got a question from Sophia. Dr. Hoffman, I'm a 77-year-old woman. On a recent bone density test, my lumbar spine results range to as much as negative 2.5.
That's precisely the cutoff for osteoporosis, is less than 2.5.
2.9, I'm sorry.
So 2.9 is across.
Negative 2.9.
2.9 is negative 2.9. Is in the range of osteoporosis. 2.2, 2.1, 1.6, that's still just osteopenia.
Yeah. And the right femur, the left femur neck is also a negative 2.5, 2.9. I'm sorry, I keep saying 2.5, 2.9. And the left forearm, a negative 2.6.
Yeah, forget it.
Why are they even measuring the left forearm?
That's a waste of time. Yeah.
It really is a waste of time. And Sophia's asking, can nutritional therapy alone address this, or am I relegated to pharmaceuticals?
Well, it's...
She's 77.
It's kind of a situational thing because, you are in a bit of a danger zone. And so, this is a very typical consultation, when I see patients is... what about your particular circumstances? Is there time to undertake aggressive nutritional support with things like strontium, vitamin K, vitamin D? Can there be
magnesium, DHEA,
all the different things, and then also some resistance exercise, weight bearing exercise,
adequate animal protein?
Could be. But, it's going to be hard to answer this on the radio because I would want to supervise someone like this very closely. I would want to get them to do a DEXA in a year to see if some of these things were improving or at least staying the course on the bone density loss, and also maybe do a test like an NTX2, which is a urine test, which gauges the rate at which you're losing bone. And see if indeed the interventions were making a difference. And then maybe gradually you can creep back to, minus 2.4, minus 2.2. You really should be working with a responsible, nutritionally oriented physician who is not, dead set against the use of medication, because this is a use case possibly for medication. No, look, if it was like everything was minus 3.5, I would say you got to bite the bullet. You got to take medication. If it was like everything was like, 1.8, 2.1, I'd say, no, this is just osteopenia. Definitely use natural. But you're sort of in the range where, we got to keep our eye on things because we got to get this resolved by the time you're 80. Because I mean, well, because we have to look at your health situation. Like, do you have foreseeably lots of longevity ahead? Because if you do, there's a really good chance that your bone density will affect you before you're ready to die. To me, it would be really crazy to institute medical therapy for somebody who has a limited life expectancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you don't want to, you want health span, not just lifespan. You don't want to become feeble because you're not taking care of your osteoporosis as well. So there are a lot of things to consider.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of things for Sophia to talk with her doctor about.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay.
So Layla, good point at which pause because we, as our listeners know, we divide our podcast into two parts. And so what are we going to tackle in part two? Give us a preview.
Are you familiar with Dr. Newbold's approach to diet? And I've been low carb for a long time until I recently ate a bagel.
Oh, okay. We're going to find out about that slippery slope when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. And you can get in on the action with a question by sending questions to questions@drhoffman.net. And we'll answer your questions in a subsequent broadcast. All right, Layla, let's go to side two.
Okay.
See you on the other side. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.